Remember that immediately after 7th of October, Israeli Jews and lawmakers, right, were talking about a second Nakba positively, not denying the Nakba, calling for a second Nakba. From the moment that Israel is created, there's this idea that it is unimaginable that it can perpetrate really any crime under international law, let alone genocide.
But isn't it ironic that you would be called an anti-Semite for saying something like that?
We have to be clear. There's no other way, there's no engaging in this absurd argument. Anti-Zionist Jews are not anti-Semites.
Is this why you've said the project of Israel as a security project for Jews has failed, not only in Israel, but all over the world?
Absolutely. Israeli Jews are admitting that what they're doing is in the frame of an Israeli settler colonial violence, right? That is the greater Israel idea since 1948. Maximum territory, minimum Palestinians.
Dr. Roz Siegel is a prominent Israeli-American scholar and the associate professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Stockton University. He was the first academic voice to label Israel's war on Gaza a textbook case of genocide in 2023. But that also came with a price. The University of Minnesota later rescinded a job offer to him over his comments. So, today we'll speak to him not only about his background and personal experience, but also about his decision to call it a genocide in 2023. And he joins us now from Philadelphia. Dr. Roz Siegel, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Real Talk.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Professor, we're going to delve into a few things this conversation. I think the starting point is really what's been a major talking point the last, 16, 17 months or so. You've called Gaza a textbook case of genocide. Now, firstly, how does one get there with conviction?
Well, it is actually it is constantly important to restate the argument and the argument for genocide in Israel's attack on Gaza from the very beginning, that is, really immediately after the Hamas-led attack on Israel on the 7th of October, and to remind people of the evidence for this argument. And it's important because of two things. Two related things. One is that it's constantly questioned, this argument. There's sometimes it's even questioned that, that there's any crimes under international law in Israel's attack on Gaza. But of course, the fact that we are witnessing a case of genocide is constantly questioned. And it's questioned, and this is the second thing in the broader frame of Nakba denial, because we really understand Israel's attack on Gaza is an integral part of an ongoing Nakba, of an Israeli settler colonial assault on Palestinians since the 1948 Nakba. And if we actually talk about settler colonialism, Zionist settler colonialism, then we actually have to start before 1948 and the 1948 Nakba, but at the very least, since the 1948 Nakba. So there's the broader frame of Nakba denial that is unfortunately structural in Israel and in the West since 1948, right? And has become very much operative, that is, after October 2023. So Nakba denial and then the continuous questioning and denial of genocide and Israel's attack on Gaza. So let's, very briefly, why did I write this piece basically on the 13th of October 2023? How so soon after 7th of October, right? These are the kind of questions that people ask. Sometimes they're framed, in a very accusatory tone. How dare you?
You were one of the first to do it.
Yeah, I think I was actually the first, but here are some of the issues and also some of the evidence. First of all, I want to remind everyone that I'm a Jewish scholar of the Holocaust and of the Jewish world. I grew up with grandparents who went through and survived World War II and the Holocaust in Bulgaria and in Romania. I've been studying and teaching and writing about the Holocaust and about more broadly about genocide. If we, if we take the starting point, say, the time when I was a master's student back in Tel Aviv University in Israel, then it's more than 20 years now. And one of the things that that in a way motivated me to pursue a career in this field, right, is the idea that it should be possible, right, to prevent genocide. Okay. Now I know this sounds perhaps idealistic, right, or naive, but that's genuinely part of the reason that I decided to do a master's, go on to do a PhD, and work, that is, conduct research and teach and write work in this field, Holocaust and genocide studies. We might want to go back and explore this title of the field at some point, but
We will. No, we will definitely.
so genocide prevention is based on the idea and on the practice that we don't just recognize genocide after it happened and after it's complete, right? Genocide prevention is precisely based on the idea that we learn from the history of genocide, that we learn from the history of the Holocaust, right? What is that dictum, never again, if not that, right? That we know that there are various indicators that tell us that genocide, that there's a significant danger for genocide, that perhaps genocide has started to unfold, right? And then we can, there are perhaps all kinds of things that we can do on all kinds of levels, right? The international level, national levels, civil society, so on and so forth, to stop it, to prevent it, right? So that is one way to think about why I wrote what I wrote on the 13th of October. Now, that is when people say, well, wasn't it too early to raise the alarm? No, it wasn't, right? Why wasn't it? Because we were all hearing and seeing and witnessing explicit statements of what's called in the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide from 1948, the UN Genocide Convention, explicit statements of intent to destroy a group, that is Palestinians, as such, in the language of the convention.
And Professor, you're referring to what Israeli officials like Yoav Gallant, the former defense minister, when he said we're fighting human animals, when other lawmakers said that there are no innocents in Gaza, when Netanyahu invoked the Amalek as well.
So we've been here, Israel's war minister at the time, Yoav Gallant, right? And I insist on referring to him as war minister rather than defense minister, right? On the 9th of October already, he told us very clearly that Israel is imposing a total siege, right? We have to remember this is following a 16-year siege on Gaza, where Israel calculated the calories that that Palestinians will be able, should be able to eat, controlled, the air, sea, land borders, right? The longest siege in modern history, 16 years. Now Gallant was telling us that he's imposing a total siege, right? Total siege, that is, total. right? We don't, there's, you know, the statements that we heard, right? That Palestinians are human animals, that Israel is imposing a total siege that is on every, you know, there is no difference between combatants, civilians, right? This key differentiation in international law and the law, you know, humanitarian, you know, international humanitarian law, the laws of war. No, everyone, no fuel, no food, no medical supplies, no nothing, right? And then at the same time, we were already seeing, right, intentionally indiscriminate bombings of Gaza. Okay, where Israeli military, you know, senior Israeli officers in the Israeli army, lawmakers, as you said, Israeli leaders, including Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, we're talking about the fact that the aim is, you know, maximum damage, right? They were telling us this in plain language, right? And then came the 13th of October. And what happened on the 13th of October? Israel's first quote unquote evacuation order. Okay. This is the day when I published a piece in Jewish Kurds. Why is this very, very significant in the argument and evidence for genocide? Because Israel was telling more than 1 million Palestinians to move from the northern part of Gaza to the southern part of Gaza in the way that Israel decided what is north and what is south in Gaza. It's interesting, by the way, that people have started to use this, you know, separation of northern Gaza, southern Gaza, which is, of course, an Israeli construct, right? But on the 13th of October, Israel was telling more than a people, million people to move immediately. Right. But they weren't just telling them to move immediately. They were telling them to move immediately under conditions of total siege following 16 years of siege. So we know that we know because they were sending text messages and voice messages that they were already feeling the effects of the total siege very much in those first few days after 7th of October. I'm not even talking about hospitals, people who are sick, people who cannot move, pregnant women, you know. Babies, children, the elderly, so on and so forth, right? But also under intentionally indiscriminate bombings of everything.
Yeah, and a lot of these safety zones or safety routes were being bombed as well.
Exactly. So this is, and we know, I mean, even the New York Times later in December 2023, right, in a big investigative piece, right, showed everyone who cared that Israel was using the most destructive US-made bombs, the 2,000-ton bombs, specifically in the south, where it had, you know, instructed Palestinians to flee from the north, specifically on the routes that Israel has designated as safe routes, right? And we know, actually, again, because Palestinians were sending voice messages and text messages immediately after 7th of October, so we have these kinds of testimonies basically that the bombings in the safe zones, quote unquote, were so severe that in some cases, Palestinians who had fled south decided to flee back to the north because they you know, decided that it's there, they have more chances of survival there rather than in the south. So the evacuation order, quote unquote, as later, you know, Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory since 1967. Later, she called it in her report humanitarian camouflage, right? So the use of safe zones in international humanitarian law, not in order to protect civilians, which is their function in international law, but actually in order to enhance the targeting of civilians, right? Which is what Israel actually did, right? This was again accompanied by explicit statements, and not one or two. And as you said, it wasn't just in the heat of the moment after October 7th, of the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th. It was in the weeks, in the month. We're still hearing anyone who follows the Israeli media right? And is following the Israeli press, the Hebrew language press, has been exposed in the last 16, 17 months, also by the, political and military leadership of the state, but also just in the public sphere in Israel, to outright genocidal language, right? It hasn't stopped.
I also want to add, to ask your thoughts. One of the last interviews that Biden gave before he left office, he said that he told Netanyahu that he can't, carpet bomb a population. To which Netanyahu, if I'm remembering correctly, he said that you did this in World War II.
I said, "But Bibi," I said, "you can't be carpet bombing these communities." And he said to me, "Well, you did it. You carpet bomb, not his exact words, but you carpet bomb Berlin. You dropped a nuclear weapon. You killed thousands of innocent people because you had to in order to win a war."
And a lot of people at the time were using that clip as some sort of additional indictment of Netanyahu's actions in the war.
Yeah, so I'll come back to this. I just want to, and this is a very important actually comment in the reference to bombings in World War II. But just to complete my argument about the evidence for genocide, by the 13th of October, right, with clear intent to destroy, right, with the carpet bombings, right, with the evacuation order that was clearly not, meant to protect Palestinians, but actually to enhance their targeting. It was clear, right, that we are actually seeing what's called in the language of the UN Genocide Convention, the third crime, the third act of genocide, that is creating conditions calculated to bring about the physical destruction of the group in whole or in part, right? Total siege, carpet bombings, evacuation orders. So it was clear to me that we're already seeing either a genocide that had started to unfold, or that we there's a clear danger of genocide. And it's important to remind everyone that the UN Genocide Convention is activated, right, when there is a clear danger. We don't have to actually have the evidence for genocide itself. We just have to be in the realm when there's a clear danger. And I think that explicit genocidal statements and the forms of violence that we saw in those first few days, right, were without a doubt clear indications that there's at least a real danger for genocide, right? To go back to your comment now that you just asked about the reference to bombings during World War II. This is, in Netanyahu's mind, in the minds of, I would say the vast majority of Israeli Jews today, right? They don't see Palestinians as Palestinians, right? One of the conditions we know historically, also from the Holocaust, for a genocidal attack on a group is dehumanization. And dehumanization of Palestinians in Israeli politics and society and culture started well before 7th of October 2023, and of course, intensified significantly after 7th of October 2023. Human animals, Yoav Gallant that we mentioned, for example, but also the depiction, the weaponization of the Holocaust, right, and the depiction of Palestinians as Nazis. 7th of October, basically, as somehow, we jump from the Holocaust to 7th of October, right? There's nothing in between. 7th of October is some kind of continuation of the Holocaust, right? And then Palestinians become Nazis. Israeli Jews become defenseless Jews in the Holocaust. This is, of course, a world turned upside down. It's actually a world that Biden created for us when he visited Israel shortly after 7th of October, and in a speech created this exact weaponization, used exactly this weaponization of the Holocaust, right? And which, of course, then a nuclear power and a very powerful state, right, that has attacked for decades a defenseless population under occupation and siege, right? Becomes powerless Jews and Palestinians, therefore they're in this kind of depiction become Nazis. This is important, and this reference to this exchange, I haven't seen that exchange, by the way, but if it, if it happened in that way, as you said, it's not surprising, because in the eyes of Israeli Jews and in Netanyahu's mind, Israel's attack on Gaza is outside the bounds of international law, because it's a war against Nazis. It's a war against human animals. It's a war against barbarians, right? And it's important to understand that this also points us to the origins of international law, because international law, of course, emerged to regulate wars between civilized nations, that is, Europeans. It was never meant to apply to colonial warfare, that is, Europeans putting down indigenous uprisings and rebellions, right? Which is how Israeli Jews are understanding what's going on. So if this is a war against Nazis, and if in order to defeat the Nazis, everything was permissible, and indeed, carpet bombings of German cities by the Allies, was part of defeating the Nazis, then it's also permissible. In this case, everything is actually permissible. There is no law in Israeli Jewish minds here, and in Netanyahu's eyes.
And is there a link to draw here between, you talked about the Holocaust, and the Holocaust in history is quite unique, isn't it? The study of the Holocaust, it makes it quite a unique atrocity, in history in general. But in a way, does it also kind of look at Israel as a state that is incapable of committing a genocide?
No, the Holocaust isn't unique, actually.
No, but the perception of it makes it
So,
look like it is a unique atrocity,
we've
is what I'm
had,
trying to say.
of course, the public perception of the Holocaust as unique is very much alive, absolutely. Even though we have, significant scholarship in Holocaust and genocide studies, for at least 20 years now, that, shows clearly that the Holocaust was not unique. Now, it's important to say, any historical case and any case of genocide has specific elements, characteristics, right, within particular contexts and so on and so forth. In that sense, we can say that any case is unique, right? But of course, when we talk about Holocaust uniqueness, that's not the meaning of the word unique, right? I mean, this ties to the name of the field that I work in, Holocaust and Genocide Studies, which is a very strange title, right? I mean, if the Holocaust was a case of genocide, this title is bizarre.
Exactly, it's singling it out.
Exactly. So now we can go into, why the Holocaust is not unique and everything. And again, there's a lot of scholarship, but the point is that, yes, in public perception, this idea persists that the Holocaust is unique. And it's, also based on the idea that Jews are a unique people, actually. Now, this is well before, this idea that Jews are foundational in the Judeo-Christian, right, world and the Judeo-Christian civilization. It's there's this enhances the idea that what happens to Jews is also somehow unique, including the Holocaust, of course. And then there's much more to say about the construction of the Holocaust as unique as a political project after World War II, both by the West, by the way, and by the Soviet Union. But the idea that Jews are unique, and then the idea that the Holocaust is unique, then definitely also means that Israel, the self-proclaimed Jewish state, right, the state where indeed a lot of Holocaust survivors tried to build their lives, is also unique, right? So from the moment that Israel is created, right, there's this idea that it is unimaginable that it can perpetrate really any crime under international law, let alone genocide, right? Because it's
And
this.
that was my question exactly,
Yeah.
yes.
Yeah. Now, that's also the origins of, this, widespread idea in Israel, certainly, but also in the West, that the Israeli army is somehow the most moral army in the world, right? Which is a very strange, I mean, it's a childish way to think about the
And
world
it's
around.
only Western governments that say it, really.
No, of course, I said a very dominant idea in Israel and the West, right?
Right.
Obviously, when we look at the idea that Israel is unique as well, this is the origins of impunity, basically, in international law for Israel, right? That Israel, it's an unimaginable and unspeakable that Israel can commit any crime under international law. That's why Israel could, I always say, think about the settler project, the post-1967 settler project, right? When we have today 800,000 to 900,000 Jews in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, which is a crude violation of international law, right? Black letter, plain, right? You are not allowed to settle, an occupier is not allowed to settle their population in occupied territory, right? How can it go on for decades, right? Involving, of course, massive violence against Palestinians, dispossession of, and theft of land and resources, and of course, mass incarceration of Palestinians and violence and killings and deportations and so on and so forth. How can it go on for decades with all of us witnessing and watching this, right? It wasn't hidden, right? Impunity for Israel. Now, I'm just referring here to us to your comment about the West, this idea, this how this idea functions in the West. The international legal system has not only failed, right, Palestinians for decades, and then has also failed them after October 2023, because again, we are, 16, 17 months of genocidal violence. Gaza is, the north of Gaza certainly is destroyed completely, but all of the Gaza Strip is has been, destroyed. But it international legal system has not only failed Palestinians, it has failed. We live in a world with more than 120 million forcibly displaced people, right? More than 120 million. The international legal system has failed dozens of millions of people, primarily in the global south. And that's the reason that we have so much support for the Palestinian cause, and certainly so much support for the Palestinian cause after October 2023 in the global south. And it's not by accident, of course, that it was a global south country, South Africa, that filed the case on genocide against Israel in the International Court of Justice. And the reason for that is not necessarily because of people in the global south know a lot about Palestine and Palestinians, not necessarily because even they, it's at the center of their concern, right? Israel's attack on Gaza. And so, because they recognize here, because of the special status of Israel in this system, right? Because of the idea of the Holocaust as unique and Israel as unique, they recognize here an opportunity for, I would say, a radical transformation of the international legal system that has failed them for decades and decades and decades, right? This is why we have, this is one of the reasons that we have so much support in the global South, or among global South people, even though, of course, this first ever live stream genocide, right, should touch anyone. Right. I mean, the images that we've been seeing for 16, 17 months on our screen, right? The horrendous videos, thousands of videos that Israeli soldiers and officers have uploaded to social media documenting their own crimes, right? Should, shock anyone, right?
Which this takes me to my next question, Raz. And for the record, you've given me permission to call you Raz.
Absolutely.
Given everything you've said, we've talked about why you called it a genocide. Now, given everything you've said in support of that, why is it so easy to refute calling it a genocide or calling Gaza a genocide? What are people overlooking?
I don't think it's easy, actually. I think that what you have in many cases is actually not a successful, argument against the argument for genocide. And we also have to remind everyone that there's also, overwhelming evidence for war crimes and crimes against humanity. I mean, there's arrest warrants, active arrest warrants by the International Criminal Court against Netanyahu and against Gallant, right? For war crimes and crimes against humanity, not genocide yet, but in many cases, I think in the vast majority of cases, we haven't actually seen a successful counter argument, right? Because the evidence is so overwhelming. I mean, just take what I just mentioned, the thousands of videos of Israeli officers and soldiers documenting their own crime explicitly, right? This is, by the way, very important because they actually show us how they understand the intent to destroy Palestinians as such on the political and leadership level, how it actually does shape violence on the ground, right? And we need to show this actually when we talk about genocide, right? That the intent actually shapes the dynamics of violence on the ground. And we see this actually through these videos that Israeli Jews are willingly uploading to social media. They're doing this because, as I said, they don't recognize that this is within the bounds of international law at all. And they don't recognize that Palestinians are actually humans, deserving of rights, dignity, respect of international law, and so on and so forth. Now, so in that sense, we haven't seen, a good counter argument. What we have seen is an insistence, right, an ideological insistence on the idea of Israel uniqueness. And we have seen, of course, a crude weaponization of Holocaust history and a crude weaponization of the struggle against anti-Semitism, right, to say that if you dare, for example, to raise the argument, right, that Israel is perpetrating genocide in Gaza, then we don't have to engage with the evidence because it's anti-Semitism, right? And now this is a very powerful, of course, attack, right? The accusation of genocide. Now we're not talking about the evidence anymore. We're talking about whether you're an anti-Semite or not, right? That's what we're seeing primarily. I can't, and correct me if I'm wrong or if you've seen otherwise, but I have not seen a good argument against the overwhelming evidence, right, for genocide, but also for crimes against humanity and war crimes in this case.
Yeah, it's not even what I was trying to get at. What I was trying to get with my question is that the debate isn't settled. Because you're saying that there is overwhelming evidence, yet it hasn't settled the debate. But I think you just answer it right now. It's because of this weaponization, which would take me, to another question. Is like, what is the biggest example that you would think of this weaponization of the Holocaust or anti-Semitism?
I mean, there's unfortunately...
There's a lot, I know, yeah.
Numerous examples. So this is, again, the weaponization, of the struggle against anti-Semitism did not begin on the 7th of October, 2023, right? Nothing began on the 7th of October, 2023. This weaponization really is an Israeli state project that emerged in the 1990s in order to make sure that critique of Israel could be addressed in a way that will not require actually engagement with any kind of evidence. For example, because the settler project was so, open for all of us to see, right? Rather, it will be, silenced, and people will be intimidated not to criticize Israel. Now, why in the 1990s? Because in the 1990s, we see an emerging discourse about Israeli settler colonialism that is beyond, I mean, Palestinians have been writing about Israeli settler colonialism since the 50s, since the early 50s, right? So from the very beginning. In the 1990s, we see other people raising the settler colonial framework to discuss Israel and Israeli history and Israeli violence against Palestinians. We also see an emergence of discussions of settler colonialism in other places, in the US and Canada and Australia. Again, many people have been talking about settler colonialism in this case, in these cases before the 1990s. And in order to respond to this kind of new development, right, the Israel adopts, right, the weaponization of the struggle against anti-Semitism, specifically, as I said, as a way not to deal with evidence, right? When I say the weaponization of the struggle against anti-Semitism, one key issue to, and then I'll, you know, I'll I think I'll note some key examples that you asked me, but one of the things to remind everyone here, which is very, very important, is that the struggle against anti-Semitism emerges in the late 19th century. At the moment that we have the emergence of modern anti-Semitism as a political movement in Germany, in the German Empire in the late 19th century, and the struggle against anti-Semitism is meant to protect. The struggle is a struggle that Jews are engaged in together with people who support them, and it's meant to protect Jews, a people, from discriminatory and violent states, right? What does the weaponization do? It again also creates a world turned upside down, right? Now we're not talking about a people under attack by states. We are now protecting a state from criticism of its attack against the people, Palestinians. Right, so now we're not talking about Jews anymore, we're talking about Israel. One of the side effects of this weaponization, of course, is that it actually puts Jews in more danger, right? Rather than protect Jews around the world, right? Because, for example, it feeds into this conflation of a people and a state, right? Now, Israel claims that basically all the only way to be a Jew is to identify with Israel or to be a Zionist, right? So what is it true, this idea about double loyalty, right? This anti-Semitic idea that Jews are not loyal really to wherever they are, right? They're loyal to Israel. This enhances this anti-Semitic idea. It also enhances an anti-Semitic idea that Jews have somehow special access to power, because why are we singling out anti-Semitism? Why in the US aren't we talking about, anti-Black racism in this kind of way, right? Which is arguably much more significant in US history, right? You can say so.
Is this why you've said the project of Israel as a security project for Jews has failed, not only in Israel, but all over the world?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Israel is not a project that has managed to, to deliver on the promise of security, this kind of post-Holocaust security for Jews that was framed, by the way, in the exact the same way that led to the Holocaust. That is the exclusionary nation state, right? The only why were Jews part of the way in which Jews were targeted during World War II and the Holocaust throughout Europe is through the nation state framework, the exclusionary nation state framework, right? The only people who really belong in the nation state, it could be the Hungarian nation state, the Romanian nation state, the German nation state, and so on and so forth, are the people defined as German, Hungarian, Romanian, etc., in the eyes of the state, right? And of course, Jews were not part of that construction, and others were not. We can think about Roma, by the way, right, which is a very important issue, but deserves a separate discussion. But after the Holocaust, we took this construct of the exclusionary nation state, which was part of the problem, and reproduced it, right, in the Israeli nation state, adding to it, of course, a layer of the settler state, right? So Israel is at the intersection, actually, of settler colonialism, white supremacy, and the exclusionary nation state, right? All the things that were not good for Jews and actually led us to Nazism and the Holocaust. So of course, it did not work, right? This idea about security and the exclusionary nation state, right? It doesn't work, by the way, for anyone really, right? I mean, did the Nazi project work for Germans? right? Of course, it didn't work for the dozens of millions of victims of the Nazis, first and foremost Jews, but it also didn't work for Germans at the end of the war so well, I think, right? So yes, the weaponization of the struggle against anti-Semitism enhances the insecurity of Jews around the world, right?
But isn't it ironic that you would be called an anti-Semite for saying something like that?
Oh, I mean, all of this is crazy, right? I mean, it's beyond ironic. It's really, really crazy, right? That and it's not just me. Think about it. You know, we have Israeli Jewish scholars of the Holocaust and genocide. We can think about Omer Bartov. We can think about Amos Goldberg, in you know, and others, right? We can think about a lot of Jewish scholars, not only Israelis, right, who have talked about Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide and Israel's attack on Gaza and have been critical of Israeli crimes and mass violence and mass atrocities against Palestinians before October 2023, right? Barry Trachtenberg, for example, many others, right? So now we're in a situ in this crazy situation where Jews and Jewish and Israeli Jews, right, who deal with the Holocaust, who study the Jewish world, who study genocide, right, who come, many of them come from families with Holocaust survivors, right? Now these people are anti-Semites, right? Which of course they're not, right? But it's a very, you know, it's a very, very powerful attack because it also has, you know, an effect that is, you might say, you know, it's almost, perhaps it's almost inevitable, certainly in the media kind of atmosphere in which we live, right? That then immediately the discussion is not about what they're saying about Israel and Israeli state violence, but about,
It's about your Jewishness.
yeah, how are you Jewish? Are you, maybe this is anti-Semitism, you know, or, you know, I don't, so it's a very powerful mechanism, and it has worked, right, for Israel in the international legal system and in the West since the 1990s, since the emergence of this weaponization, right? It hasn't worked so well in the global South, right? Again, if we remind everyone that the world doesn't, you know, begin and end in the US or with the West, right? Now today, we're seeing, you know, an attack. So there's many individuals who are affected by this. This weaponization, first and foremost, of course, targets Palestinians, and it targets other Arabs, and it targets Muslims, who Palestinians or others, who speak out about Israel and Palestine. But it also more and more, increasingly more, targets Jews, right? And
And just to note, this attack here that we're talking about, it's attacking how you express your Jewish identity or how you
exactly.
express the way that you're an anti-Zionist Jewish man. And it doesn't seem like the engagement is what you're saying or what you're writing.
No, not at all. I mean, that's what I'm saying, that it's a way not to engage with that wall, right? You know, the paradigmatic case really of in the academic world, I mean, in the academic world where I work, right, this attack is particularly grotesque, right? Because the academic world is supposed to be committed to documented reality, to research, to teaching, or, you know, let's be kind of old school here first. I'll bring out my old school historian here for a second, right? Truth, right? Because in some cases, and I've said this before, right? It feels that, you know, you're standing with someone outside in the middle of the day, right? And you're saying, you know, it's the middle of the day, right? And they turn to you and they say, no, it's the middle of the night. And if you say that it's the middle of the day, you're an anti-Semite. Right? That's how it feels. I mean, it's so absurd, it's so grotesque. And in the academic world, I mean, the paradigmatic case, an awful case of an attacking an anti-Zionist Jew for her critique of Israel and Israeli genocide in Gaza is, of course, Maura Finkelstein, who the tenured faculty member was fired, right? So this is also, you know, so it's not just, I mean, we have hundreds, if not more, cases of people who are adjunct, right, in adjunct positions who their positions were not renewed or they were fired or in other ways removed, right? But Maura Finkelstein is a case where a tenured faculty member was fired, no less because of, if I'm not mistaken, because she liked a post on social media, right? And this idea, and it signals to us, you know, the that this is indeed so challenging, right? And this is in a U.S. university, a U.S. college, right? And we might ask, you know, why is a discussion about a different country, Israel, right, so challenging in the U.S. academic framework, right? Now, of course, I've been attacked as well,
Yeah,
right?
I was going to say something similar has happened to you too, you know, with the
Not
University of
in
Minnesota.
Minnesota. Yeah, not similar. I mean, you know, I was offered I have
Or a
my
job offer was rescinded, yes.
yeah. I haven't lost my job, I think, in Mara Finkelstein case, and this is why it's so significant because it points to what's, you know, to the new normal, as it were, right? That tenure, and of course, this isn't a broader attack against the academic world that's been going on for a couple decades at least now, including an attack on this system of tenure, right? So there's a broader issue here about the academic world that the issue of Palestine fits into. But what the case of Maura Finkelstein signifies is that, you know, nothing protects you now. You know, if you will express your anti-Zionism, right, even if you're a Jew, and if you even if the evidence that you base what you're saying on is very strong, right, you might lose your job even if you have tenure in the academic world. Now, I have a tenured position at Stockton University in New Jersey, where, you know, where I have so far you know, had support on my campus, right? And that's significant. But I was offered a position to head the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at the University of Minnesota. And it was together with a tenured position, associate professor of history and you know, in the history department. And both of these, the academic position and the position to head the center, were withdrawn within days back in June 2024, following a coordinated attack against me by the Jewish Community Relations Council of the Minnesota and the Dakotas, which really is today an organization that is much less concerned with Jews in the Minnesota and the Dakotas and much more functions as an Israeli advocacy group, basically, right?
Let me just read what they said about when the university was offering you the position. I mean, they released this statement, which I'm sure you've read back then, in June 9th, 24. They said that the University of Minnesota is planning to hire a prominent anti-Zionist professor, Ross Siegel, to be the next director of its Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies. Outrageously, Siegel accused Israel of genocide on October 13th, 2023. His debunked extremist views include calling Israel a settler colonial power and dismissing concerns about campus anti-Semitism. This person is plainly unfit to lead this venerable Minnesota institution. Technically, this appointment can still be blocked, but it will require a massive outcry from the community to university leadership expressing our outrage of the weaponization of Holocaust studies against Israel and the Jewish people. Now, just even hearing that back,
I mean, it's the level of craziness is really so there's, you know, there's a number of things there to unpack, right? So let's start, and we'll see where we get. One is, of course, the fact that anti-Zionism is an illegitimate, right, position. It's really anti-Semitism, right? So, this kind of position that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism is so ridiculous because, of course, it completely it erases the fact that anti-Zionism emerged in the Jewish world with Zionism, right? And it was a form of Jews expressing their Jewish identity, right? And there were many anti-Zionist Jews and anti-Zionist Jewish organizations and anti-Zionist Jewish political parties, and there are still today anti-Zionist Jews and anti-Zionist Jewish organizations and an integral part of the Jewish world, right? And to say that this is now somehow anti-Semitism is just crazy and grotesque and false, right? Completely, right? There's just, we have to be clear. There's no other way, there's no engaging in this absurd argument. Anti-Zionist Jews are not anti-Semites, right? Point. There's nothing else to say about this, right? People might be offended. People might be, feel that, these people are too extreme or whatever it is, right? And we can have a debate and we can discuss and right. But they're not anti-Semites, anti-Zionist Jews, right? And that's just as clear as day, right? And these are people, again, a lot of anti-Zionist Jews are actually very much involved for a long, long time, right? In the struggle against, in the real struggle against anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism in the United States, for example, is a very real issue. It's a
Sure,
very
yeah.
real issue. We actually have seen a
Absolutely.
spike in anti-Jewish violence in the U.S. since
Yes.
2016. I wonder what
Yes.
happened then, right? In 2016, anti-Semitism has been a very real issue in the United States. Anti-Semitic violence has been a very real issue in the United States. It's still a very real issue. It's actually increasing. And many anti-Zionist Jews, much more than the people who attack them, actually, in many cases, have been very involved in the struggle against this, right? So this is a crude, crazy allegation that we need to address in this way. We need to dismiss it, right? There's no way I mean, engaging with it is already giving it a certain level of validation.
But even the dangers of the dangers of a group like this interfering in the hiring process of a public university.
No, this is so, I think that what happened in the University of Minnesota is that following the rescinding of my offer, faculty in the College of Liberal Arts, but actually across the university, a majority of faculty, actually, there was a no confidence vote in both the interim president, Ettinger, who withdrew my offer, and in the provost, and there was a non-confidence vote in the College of Liberal Arts, but also in the entire university. So a majority of faculty in the university voted no confidence in the interim president, who actually left shortly thereafter. In any case, he was interim, and in the provost, and many of the faculty members in the University of Minnesota were up in arms about this. Not all of them at all actually supported my position, right, on Israel's attack on Gaza as genocide, for example, right? But many of them said that this is extremely dangerous, right? Because clearly I'm speaking from a professional perspective, right? Actually, this is a very clear First Amendment issue, right? Involves free speech, but also academic freedom. And they said, well, if a job offer could be withdrawn in this way, and by the way, no one at any point in the process raised any concerns about my professional and academic qualifications, right? It was only about what I said and wrote on Gaza. And the faculty in the university said, well, if this could, if the university can do this, this could be a precedent and they could do it. It opens the door for any pressure group, right, on any issue, right?
Sure.
Extremely dangerous. And again, part of a larger attack against the academic world that's been going on for quite a long time in the United States and in other places. So there's of course this issue. But I want to go back to what you read to me, right? That the
Yeah, please.
JCRC wrote about me. Now, think about one of the things that they wrote, that said, how dare this person talk about Israeli settler colonialism, right? Which is a reality in front of our eyes. That even just if we just consider the post-1967 settler movement and settler reality, right, of nearly a million Jews now in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, right? And also if we consider the discourse in Israel after October 2023, that is, the settler discourse about Gaza, right? That this is an opportunity now, right, to settle again in Gaza, right? To destroy Palestinians and, right, to destroy, in October 2024, we had a big gathering of settler leaders just outside of Gaza. There were also actually government ministers, because of course the Israeli government today is controlled by settlers, right? Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, right? These are explicit settler leaders. So there were settler leaders, there were government ministers, there were lawmakers right outside of Gaza in a gathering that its title was Plans to Settle Gaza. Now, here we have a group in the United States who said, you cannot tell us that it's the middle of the day, right? You cannot tell us what Israeli Jews are saying now explicitly, unashamed, right? That Israel's attack on Gaza is indeed in the frame of an ongoing Nakba. Remember that immediately after 7th of October, Israeli Jews and lawmakers, right, were talking about a second Nakba. Positively, not denying the Nakba, calling for a second Nakba, right? Calling about the Gaza Nakba, right? And again, we have this also from videos of soldiers and officers in Gaza, again, on the political level and on the ground, right? Israeli Jews are admitting that what they're doing is in the frame of an Israeli settler colonial violence, right? That is the greater Israel idea since 1948, maximum territory, minimum Palestinians. Here's a group in the US, the JCRC of the Minnesota and the Dakotas, and say, you can't talk about this reality. If you talk about this reality that we all see in front of our eyes and hear, that Israeli Jews are admitting to openly, right, you're an anti-Semite, right? This is, and again, in the academic world particularly, so grotesque and so dangerous, right? Now, of course, it has now, with the new Trump administration here in the United States, has exploded into, really an un, you know, a monstrosity that blows your mind, right? When we have, if you think about this Project Esther, right, within the Project 2025 people, right, this, I. policies about anti-Semitism, which is not, it's policies about the weaponization of anti-Semitism. It's policies about, attacking Palestinians and silencing critique of Israel. But it's policies that are crafted by people who are themselves anti-Semites and white supremacists, right? And racists, right? Who are now managing anti-Semitism policies, right? So again, one of the many examples of, the absurdity that's blowing up in front of us, specifically here in the US, but not only in the US. We can think about Germany, of course, where there's, a similar reality of absurdity that we have to deal with, and, very severe silencing, weaponization of the struggle against anti-Semitism, and so on and so forth. So this is, this is where we are, right? All of this also means, by the way, that we're in an extreme crisis in the Jewish world, right? Extreme crisis in the Jewish world, right? But we're also in a situation that has just become, absurd beyond imagination, right?
You've also cited that before. You've cited this crisis in the, or not crisis, but you said that there was a massive disagreement over the definition of anti-Semitism, or more specifically, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism in the Jewish world.
Yeah, I mean, there's again, the Swapanization is led through a major international organization of global Holocaust memory, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, and its adoption in 2016 of the working definition of anti-Semitism, right? And this definition has a very vague definition, which is not actually the issue. The issue is the 11 examples attached to it as an integral part, seven of which are about Israel and Zionism and not at all about Jews, so it really embodies this conflation of a people and a state and the shifting of the focus from Jews to Israel and to Zionism. And I mean, and also, we have to be clear in the US context, and this is a weaponization that's happening very much now in the US context, again, also in Germany and other places, but it's very paradigmatic what's happening in the US. And in the US context, right, there's a First Amendment right, there's a constitutional right, right, of free speech. I can criticize any state in the world, its policies, and any political ideology. I can say that Russia's attack on Ukraine has genocidal elements, as I think that it does, right? And no one would argue that this is a anti-Russian racist argument, right? I can criticize any state and political ideology in the US. That's First
Yes.
Amendment, right? The only case, right, where it will actually be outlawed, right, if the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act now will pass and become law, right, is in the case of Israel and Zionism, right? Which again, by the way, enhances anti-Semitism, right? Because it enhances the exceptional status of Jews, the exceptional status of Israel. It makes people think that Jews have somehow special access to power to pass legislation only about Jews in this way. Not why not about Black people? Why not about Native people? What about anti-Native indigenous racism in the United States? Arguably, very, very significant in U.S. history and in the present. No, only Jews, right? But this is also just a crude violation of First Amendment and a violation of the U.S. Constitution, right? What we're calling now here in the U.S. and other, in relation to other issues, right, a constitutional crisis. So again, this is it's the IHRA definition, right, is not protecting Jews, right? It's enhancing the insecurity of Jews. It's enhancing the insecurity of many, many Jews, not only anti-Zionists, but others as well, right, who cannot be safe, right, living in a under a federal government, right, that begins with a Nazi salute, right? Elon Musk giving two, not one, two Nazi salutes,
And
right?
Steve Bannon just recently accused of
Yes.
doing one as well, yeah.
Saw that it's contagious, right? It's you start and so it's the fact that there are Jews who think that Jews could be safe under a federal government that begins with a Nazi salute that is run by white supremacists, right? It blows your mind, right? All this means, of course, that the struggle against this, right, which has been going on for a long, long time, well before 7th of October 2023, well before even the first Trump administration in 26, needs to continue even more. We need more collaborations. We need more partnerships between Jews and Palestinians and others in this, because again, it doesn't, if we have a constitutional crisis, this does not apply only to Jews, of course, right? This is an attack that is much broader than just an attack against Jews. And, why is the US and the Israel so committed to attacking the international legal system, right? Having sanctions on the ICC and disregarding the International Court of Justice, right? Because we are in a moment actually of significant change, There is potential, as I mentioned, of radical change also in the international legal system. It's hard to imagine it in some way in this moment, right, of violence and of the rise of fascism in this way that we see. But there is potential for radical change. And the fact that this is such a severe attack, actually, this is such an absurd and grotesque attack in the US and Germany and other places, the fact that we see these kinds of attack on the international legal system now is because, right, state leaders recognize the potential for radical change, right? So it's very, very real. The danger itself, of course, the violence, but also the potential for radical change is very much there. And therefore the struggle to realize it, it's very difficult to continue in the struggle, right, when we're faced with this kind of absurdity, this kind of grotesque, this just assault on the truth, the documented reality in front of our eyes. But it has to continue, and it is continuing.
And this takes me to another question. I'm aware of the time here, even though I'm thoroughly enjoying the conversation, and I kind of don't want it to end, but I do want to respect your time commitments. I want to go back to your department of Holocaust and genocide studies. Where does this leave us? Where are we at this moment? You've said that the field itself is in deep crisis.
Look, the exceptional status of Israel, the unique status of Israel in international law that I mentioned before, is also something that structured the field of Holocaust and genocide studies, right? I mean, it's not a field where the study of Israeli mass violence, right, had a place. Right. It's not a field where Palestinian scholars focusing on Israeli mass violence had a place, right? It's actually, it's actually took a long time, right? And there's still like a in a way a separation, right, of thinking about settler colonial violence, right, as an integral part of Holocaust and genocide studies. Now, so what we're seeing is a crisis of the international legal system, for example, as I said, right? Because impunity for Israel has already cracked, right? We see a charge of genocide against Israel in the International Court of Justice. We see arrest warrants in the International Criminal Court. A lot of scholars in Holocaust and genocide studies, including Jews and Israeli Jews, as I said, who talk about the evidence for Israel's genocide in Gaza. Impunity in that sense for Israel has cracked in the international legal system, but it has also cracked, right, in Holocaust and genocide studies. Now, it's very difficult to know to predict, what might happen. And as I always say, it's kind of like a dad's joke. It's a story, and historians tend to be wrong when they predict the past, right? When they predict the future, it's, so it's very difficult. In Holocaust and genocide studies now, we have a divide, which is very unfortunate, between Holocaust, between, it's not, strictly, but there is a tendency of people who deal with the Holocaust in a more narrow sense, right, to argue that we can continue business as usual, right? And we've seen some of them, in some cases, even justifying Israel's attack on Gaza, right? Rationalizing Israel's attack on Gaza, taking part in the weaponization of the Holocaust to portray, or to suggest, kind of allude to this portrayal of Israeli Jews as defenseless Jews in the Holocaust and Palestinians as Nazis. And then scholars who deal with genocide more broadly, with mass atrocities more broadly. Many of them are much more inclined, even if they don't accept the evidence for Israel's attack on Gaza as genocide. Of course, they see war crimes and crimes against humanity, and of course think that the discussion about Israeli genocide in Gaza is an absolutely legitimate discussion. Again, because we're definitely in the realm of danger of genocide. I think we're well beyond that, right? But so there's this divide, which is in the name of the field again, Holocaust and genocide study, right? What will happen is unclear. I can tell you that, graduate students in the field, many of them, many of graduate students who, I speak with, sense a clear, they sense that there is a clear crisis, because this field, which was in a way structured in its title even, right, to maintain this idea of uniqueness. Holocaust is unique, but then again, it's a triad of uniqueness. Jews is unique, Holocaust is unique, Israel is unique, right? This is breaking down. We can't hold on to it. But there are, different places in the field, and there's, we don't have time to go into it, where there's a, there's a ideological need, right, and effort to hold on to this exceptional status of the Holocaust, Jews, and Israel uniqueness, right? And in other parts of the field, and when I say fields, I mean, research centers, universities, journals, right? So, and in other parts, there is an absolute realization that we can't hold on to it anymore, right? Now, we are also facing an unprecedented attack on the academic world, right? Today, certainly, and again, in the US, but also in Germany and in other places, which figures into this. So there's, a broader context that we need to consider. It's very difficult to, to think what will happen moving forward. But I will say this, that, as we saw, I mean, think about the fact that in the fall of 2023, we saw, massive protests around the world against Israel's attack on Gaza, actually protests that normalized the use of the word genocide publicly in relation to this attack. This had some role, actually, I think, in the fact that South Africa brought the case against Israel for genocide in the ICJ. We had in the spring of 2024 the encampment, hundreds of encampments on US campuses and around the world. There are a lot of, so we look at this kind of broader, mass protests and encampments in the academic world in the spring of 2024. If we go down now to just the Holocaust and genocide studies, there are a lot of scholars and students who, again, recognize the need to come to terms, right, with this moment of crisis, right, and are committed to thinking about it. So there is, there is a lot of uncertainty. People are scared, actually, right? Certainly if they're graduate students. So just one more thing to say about this. But there's also a lot of things that are happening, right? And will continue to happen. And I mean, that's all we can do, really, right? To continue to do what we need to do, and again, do more of it, create more partnerships, write more, speak more, protest more. Engage more in, if we think outside of Holocaust and genocide study in the political level and BDS, right, initiatives, which do have an effect in Israel, right? So all this is happening, and inshallah, it will bring a different reality.
I do have a quick final question before I let you go, Roz. You say the students are scared because of this crisis. Now, are they asking whether or not the field has failed?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of the within the field, also outside the field, but 2025 wasn't supposed to look like it looks like, right? We were supposed to be, I mean, with the fall of the Soviet Union in the 90s, and we were supposed to be at the end of history, right? but we were also supposed to be living in a world of human rights and genocide prevention and Holocaust memory, right? This hasn't worked out. Again, we live in a world of more than 120 million forcibly displaced people. It hasn't worked out well before 7th of October. It hasn't worked out not only for Palestinians. The case of Israel and Palestine is paradigmatic, and but so yes, many students, I think, and graduate students in Holocaust and genocide studies, but also many scholars recognize that there's a crisis. And that also means, to some extent, that the field has failed, right? I'm not sure how many people would frame it in this way, that is a failure, right? But certainly, in the sense of deep crisis, in the field, absolutely. And many people are, think that it's a legitimate thing to discuss crisis and failure in the field. But I think that also, and it changes from place to place, and it really depends on, the specific faculty members and scholars, the specific students, what people sense is possible, is safe. It's a very uncertain and scary time. But this also opens, people are now more and more, I think, graduate students and scholars in the field think that it's possible to address things that the framework of uniqueness of the Holocaust Jews in Israel, made it unspeakable or unimaginable or impossible to address. And not only possible, but it's actually urgent that they address it, right? So again, where will we be in a month, in a year, in 2 years? Who knows? And we might be some days hopeful about this. Some days we might be hopeless. In the same day, we might be hopeful in the morning and hopeless in the evening. But it doesn't really matter. What matters is what we do, right? And there's a lot that people are doing, and there's more that people will do, and it will continue, and that's really what matters in this moment of acute crisis.
And on that note, Professor Dr. Ross Siegel, thank you so much for taking the time to come on Real Talk. This was such a valuable conversation, and I do hope we catch up again, seriously.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity, Mohammed, and yes, I hope that we have another opportunity to continue the conversation.
And I'm sure we will. Thank you, Dr. Siegel.
Thank you so much.